It's time for Michigan's newest sports talk show, Mitten Madness.
And here he goes. Defense win championship.
Michigan sports talk from here in Battle Creek. The latest stories, the biggest games, all across the Mitten State.
That's not something to play with.
Streaming live and on demand on the 95.3 WBCK app. Here are your hosts, Jacob Harrison and Dejon Hughes.
Well, hello and good morning. This is Mitten Madness on 95.3 WBCK. Jacob Harrison and Dejon Hughes getting ready to talk Michigan sports. We're going to talk some Michigan and Michigan State stuff since we haven't in a while. Good little debate on what's going on with the Wolverines and the Spartans. We'll also get you caught up on everything going on with the Tigers and the Pistons as Tiger season kind of progresses along, and the Pistons are getting ready for the NBA draft at the end of the month. So before we get started, though, we'll get started as we always do. DJ, how's it going, man?
Oh, I'm living. I'm not too upset. I'm here. I'm breathing. I'm going to be headed out to Philly this weekend, so it'll be nice to get back out of the state of Michigan again. Actually, ironically, the only weekend I'm spending in the state of Michigan for the month of June is next weekend. Every other week, I've either already been out or already have plans to leave. So it's nice to get in during the week, grind out this this radio life, which is always fun, and then get back into enjoying myself on the weekends.
I feel that that I'm living thing because, boy, it's been a weird Friday. So I'm just trying to get through the day.
Just a weird week all around.
Get into the weekend and find something fun to do. Chill out, relax, maybe watch some sports. We'll see. Let's get into what we want to get into today, which is the futures of Michigan football and Michigan State football. Both these coaches, Sharon Moore with the Wolverines, Jonathan Smith coming in with the Spartans, kind of have clean slates to rebuild, in the case of the Spartans, rebuild, and for the case of the Wolverines to continue success in a new look conference in the Big Ten. Now, we've talked in the past a great deal about how Michigan State is kind of in a tough spot because of the incoming Pac-12 schools that are bringing the conference up to 18 teams. Not having divisions is something that is going to hurt the Spartans just as well as it's going to hurt a lot of the other mid teams in the conference, whereas Michigan kind of has that benefit of just coming off of a national championship season. However, they lose their coach, Jim Harbaugh, to the NFL. They also lose a ton of starters, particularly on the offense. You do return Donovan Edwards, and Alex Orji looks like a lot of fun at quarterback. You anticipate the offensive line is still going to be good. You still have pieces on defense, including one of the best corners in the entire country. However, for the Spartans, it's kind of a different case where you've got a lot of transfers coming in, particularly, you know, you're going to figure things out with a new quarterback, Jonathan Smith bringing in pieces from Oregon State. And one thing I really wanted to point out about Jonathan Smith for a lot of people that maybe don't pay close attention to what the Spartans have going on is Oregon State was the runs when he got there. At the end of the mid-2010s, they were 2-10 in his first season, and they weren't very good before that either. And he got things turned around progressively. 2019 going 5-7, we're going to discount 2020. I mean, that doesn't matter at all. 2021 going 7-6, 22 going 10-3, and winning the Las Vegas Bowl. Last year, a little bit of a disappointment, I will say. They were ranked number 18 going into the season, got up to 10, but they couldn't beat anybody that was kind of at the top of the Pac-12 in that fantastic final year for the conference in football. So, DJ, you kind of brought the conversation to the table where, you know, contrasting these two and who could potentially have the best start, who can have the most success longevity wise. So kind of get into it with the way that you want to here with between Jonathan Smith and Sharon Moore.
I think the bigger thing we got to look at first is, you know, the programs that they're headed into. Sharon Moore was already a part of the Michigan program. He knows the in and outs. He was running arguably the most important part of the team, the offensive line. You can't, one, run a system like Michigan, and two, you just can't really run a football team if you don't have a good offensive line. You're not going to get much done unless your defense is just unreal and you score all your points on the defensive side. But we've yet to see that really happen in a football game in a very long time. So he is already running an extremely important part of this team. So a big part of their identity laid in Sherrone Moore as it was. So now he just gets to spread that identity across his entire team. That's low-key dangerous for a lot of teams in the country. You're about to run into, you know, an absolute juggernaut in terms of how they're going to view the game of football. They already have a really good defense, and now you're going to give them this trench mentality where it's, we have to win every play. We have to be the best out here. We have to grind even when we're hurt. We can't complain. We can't whine. We're just out here balling because we know we're not going to get any recognition. That's scary. Because now you're putting the best guys who do get that recognition in this dog-like mentality to go out and just play good football. I really like what Sherrone Moore is stepping into. He has the support behind him in terms of the locker room, in terms of the other coaches, the athletic staff, you know, the fans, the alumni. Everybody loves Sherrone Moore already. He doesn't really have anything to prove other than his couple games coaching last year weren't a fluke. That's the only thing people are looking is, hey, is this guy legit? Was he just a product of having Jim Harbaugh there? And, you know, he benefited off that team that he put together? Or was he really out there coaching and doing what he knows how to do? That is the only question mark you have headed into this year about Sherrone Moore. But on the opposite side, Smith is in a very different situation. He's coming into a team that is basically scraps. You aren't really dealing with anybody you know. There's a couple guys who have come over and transfer from his old program in Oregon State. But other than those guys, you don't know this team. A good portion of his coaching staff is coming, which I think is huge. You need that support of your coaching staff. You need that help of your coaching staff. And for a group of guys that he already knows and they know how he operates and how he likes to do things is going to make that much easier on him and his coaching staff. Obviously, you don't necessarily have the support of the school yet. You got to earn that. And that's just facts in terms of you got to win games. You got to come in and bring players in that are either going to have you in close games or winning games to get you back bowl eligible. That's just the facts to that. And you don't know if you have the fans' support because the fans don't even know if they want to support the football team because the football team hasn't been good. So once again, you have to show up and prove to your fans that you're worth having them in the seats longer than halftime. Because I know a few kids who go and they're like, look, I got the pass already. I go halftime. I'm out of there because the game's just about over anyway. You got to get kids to sit longer. So he just has a few more hurdles to jump in terms of getting that support. But I think the on-field is where he's going to make those strides. And I think that's where people are maybe underestimating him or are not 100% sure what he's going to do. He took Oregon State from the bottom of the Pac-12 unranked to ranked every week. And playing good ball. And for a while, people were talking about them in the Pac-12 championship and possibly making a run. Obviously, things didn't shake out that way, but you saw the potential he had with guys over in Oregon State. So if he can get Michigan State back to where they were, this is a team that's been in the college football playoff before. So we're talking about a team that only needs a couple things in order to really, you know, make that jump. And Smith could do it. I just think he's in a little bit of a lesser position than, you know, Sherrone Moore, who was already in the program, established, and people know what they're going to be getting with him.
And one thing with Smith that I think is a very big deal is that he's a quarterback guy. He revived DJ Uiagalelei's career out at Oregon State. And now he's got Aiden Childs coming in, who is one of the most prolific recruits that Oregon State has literally ever gotten. And they've had some legends come through that program with guys like Steven Jackson and Chad Johnson and so many others. But I think that is going to be a very big deal for him because a lot of what gets kind of glossed over when these guys come into new places is, sure, you might be a good X's and O's guy, but you've got to be able to integrate yourself within the community and start to recruit in state and then recruit in the region very effectively. One advantage that Sherrone Moore is going to have over his rival up, you know, up the road is Sherrone Moore's been in Michigan almost his entire coaching career. He's been in Michigan since 2014 when he started with Central Michigan as a tight ends coach after a few years in Louisville. So he's been in this region, and even Louisville being as north as it is in Kentucky, you know, you're not that far removed from the Midwest just because you're in the Bluegrass State. So, he's very familiar with this area and he's done a lot of work here. So that's one advantage that he's going to have. That being said, the ability to turn around programs, because, Smith has been around, you know, the block, or, you know, a time or two. He's not ignorant. You know, he knows how to recruit, bring guys around. You know, when you kind of look around, Kalen DeBoer is another guy where he's been all around the country and he's managed to find success wherever he's been. And one thing that he's been very successful at, just being an Alabama grad and fan and paying attention to, is the, while he's not recruiting at the same level as Nick Saban, which is hard to imagine, Alabama's still top three in the SEC in the 2025 class. Right now, Michigan State is bottom tier. They're number 15 according to On3, and Michigan is still near the top. And so when it, I think Michigan is number four. So both teams taking a strong dip here after the coaching changes, but you've got to be able to replenish and revive yourself. So that's something I want to get into on the other side, is kind of an outlook for this upcoming season as well as kind of further on into the future. So we'll continue the conversation about Sherrone Moore and Jonathan Smith and an outlook of the 2024 season here on Mitten Madness next here on 95.3 W. Madness 95.3 WBCK, Jacob Harrison and Dejon Hughes. We're kind of way too early kind of preview here as we get deeper into the offseason where there's just not a whole lot going on. We're kind of previewing what's going on with Michigan State and Michigan football, particularly since they're one of the many teams across the country that have brand new coaches. What's it like to be Georgia right now? Kirby Smart steps into an immaculate situation. He's done nothing but take advantage of it. And now he's one of the most tenured coaches in all of football, and he doesn't ignore what NIL and the transfer portal does for the sport. So unlike Dabo Swinney, he's still on top. Everybody else has moved on or retired, and it's a new age of college football. One thing I wanted to point out, On3 posted this article about Sherrone Moore talking about what is next. How do you take over a national championship winning team with a legacy head coach that is losing so many players? I know it's hard to not compare being a fan, and also because Alabama's been on top for so long. But compare Kalen DeBoer's situation with Sherrone Moore's. Kalen still has his quarterback. Kalen still has most of his offensive line, a ton of defensive players. Like, Kalen DeBoer has a great situation to step into. Sherrone Moore, while he's got great familiarity with his program, obviously, and is coming off of, you know, he's got a 1-0 record, and that one is against Ohio State. Good job. You can't get any better at Michigan. But he's got to rebuild this entire team through a variety of ways and trust in the guys that Harbaugh had already brought into the program, as well as him. They said the only way to maintain Michigan's recent standard is to focus on the present and do so by continuing to work as they have in that span with the players that they have on the roster, and making it simple is probably the best thing for him to do. Now, all things being equal, Michigan doesn't have a particularly difficult schedule. Even when you kind of factor in the Big Ten aspects of it, sure, they're going to have two or three difficult games that they're going to have to win in order to be in a position to go to the college football playoffs, even with the expansion. But Michigan's expectations, I don't think, this season are win a national championship or bust. I think there's an understanding that this team is going to have a bit of a period, right, where they've got to transition and get back into what they're going to do and let this team kind of take on the personality of Sherrone Moore in full rather than just for one game and, you know, plus the others that Harbaugh missed due to suspension. Now, on the other hand, Michigan State just wants to win games. Just win enough to be bowl eligible. It doesn't even matter if it's a bad bowl. Interestingly, 247 Sports actually predicted recently, it was a couple months ago, that Michigan State would go 6-6 and reach a playoff game. Or excuse me, not a playoff game, a bowl game. If you kind of look at their non-conference schedule with Florida Atlantic, Prairie View A&M, they're going to win that game. And Boston College, and it's like, huh, well, you know, they're probably going to win two or three of those. Then you look at their conference schedule, which includes Maryland, Ohio State, Oregon, Iowa, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Purdue, Rutgers. That's not an easy schedule for a team that was decimated on the scoreboard every single week last year. But then also the fact that not a lot of good has come into the program outside of Jonathan Smith either. I see it as very difficult for Michigan State to get to that level, because mostly because of the murderous row that is this portion of the schedule from September to October with Ohio State, Oregon, Iowa, and Michigan. They just don't score enough points in East Lansing to contend with those programs in that stretch, to then turn around and look at the teams that you could potentially beat, Indiana, Illinois, Purdue, and Rutgers, and say, yeah, good luck, you got this. At a flip of the switch when you've been beaten up so harshly for a month straight. So, I mean, when you put it into perspective for this season alone, what are kind of your expectations for both programs? Is Michigan a legitimate college football playoff team, or are they just hoping to get a chance to win the Big Ten now that there's no divisions? And with Michigan State, is a bowl game even a realistic possibility, considering all the turnover and the turmoil that the program has been through over the past couple of years?
I think firstly, you just got to look at setting, you know, your standards and your culture. I think that's rule number one. And I think that's kind of just what I'm looking for from both coaches. You're going to be at these schools for, you know, a relative couple years. How do you handle this first year? How do you get things settled in? And how do you, you know, establish your culture, and not just for Sherrone Moore and Smith, but for coaches like DeBoer. You know, there's coaches all across the country that are setting their standard and their culture at a new school. And that's what I'm looking for in year one from a lot of guys. But as I go to pull up the schedule here, I want to get to Michigan State really quick. Realistically, with the way that they're opening up their schedule, it doesn't get hard for them until the end of September. If they can win those first four, which I think are very winnable for Michigan State, and then you sneak one from Indiana, Illinois, Purdue, Rutgers, you sneak two or three out of that group, you're automatically bowl eligible.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's far outstretched for Michigan State to possibly be bowl eligible this year due to the easiness of their schedule. I'm not saying that these teams are like not good and that they're like, this is super easy, but compared to what Michigan State could have this year with the realignment of the Big Ten and non-conference, they did a great job at preparing themselves to have a pretty solid season. So I would not be completely overthrown to see them 6-6, 7-5, something like that, squeezing in and getting a berth in a bowl game. I think it would take a lot. And I think it's you're asking for quite a bit, but I don't think it's completely out of the realm. Michigan, there's some big games on here, but really it's two of them that we're looking at. Do I think Fresno State even has a chance? No. No, they don't. I don't think Arkansas State has a chance either. Texas, it's almost like a trap game. It's in the middle of two games that you absolutely should win.
At least you got it at home.
And at least that is a home game. The other one I'm really concerned about is Ohio State on the road. Do I think Oregon will be a good game? Yes. But I think
you got it at
win,
home.
I think win or loss, one, it's at home. But I think win or loss, you're okay there. As long as you're beating Texas and you're beating Ohio State. You lose to one of those two, that possible loss to Oregon's a huge deal. So as long as they're beating Texas, I'll probably reevaluate then. Do I have them as a national contender now? Yes, because they have three games on the schedule that they are like sweating over, which means they already won nine games. Not that they have, but That's kind of how you're looking at it.
It's college football.
At the worst, you know what I'm saying? At the worst, it's 9-3. They could still sneak into the 12 team at 9-3. Are they going to?
Yeah.
They probably won a little bit better than that, but realistically, you can put them in that top 12 up front until we see the product on the field.
Yeah, and I mean, even still, I mean, for a lot of Michigan fans, 9-3 probably sounds bad, but you can beat Texas and then lose to USC, right? And you're still looking at potentially 9-3, because let's be real, like, I kind of sugarcoated Michigan's schedule earlier, but Texas is a college football playoff contender. They were in it last year. They very well could have won the whole thing had a few things gone their way. Washington obviously is not, but Oregon is potentially one of the best teams. I think Oregon's the best team in the conference. And then Ohio State is potentially the second best team in the conference. Now, you've got Ohio State's number. I think the wheels are kind of falling a little bit there with Ryan Day. He's got six quarterbacks to choose from between week one and that game. So he's got time to figure all that out. It's not going to be particularly easy. However, I will say it is more likely, I think, for Michigan to, even if they're the 12 seed, I think it's more likely for Michigan to make the college football playoff than it is for Michigan State to be bowl eligible. Now, unless they get bowl eligible at 5-7, which isn't usually the thing for power conference teams. I look at that early portion of the schedule, and sure, you've got Florida Atlantic and Prairie View A&M at home, but you got to go on the road for Maryland and Boston College. And listen, I understand both those teams are not particularly good. Maryland is going to be breaking in a new quarterback and everything like that. But Maryland typically plays the middle of the pack of the Big Ten pretty strongly. They just struggle with the powerhouses. So that's a game that Maryland can win. Boston College will catch you off guard. And then again, I think coming off of that murderous row of Ohio State, Oregon, Iowa, and Michigan, you're not going to win a single game there. It's not going to be easy to just host Indiana and be like, oh, well, historically, well, Indiana's not a team you could sleep on at this point. And then Purdue and Rutgers, I think, are a little bit tougher than Illinois as well. So it's hard for me to see that. However, I think both teams, regardless of how this year goes, they're in position to get better. I think for a long time I was kind of harshly thinking about Michigan State, but they couldn't have made a better head coaching hire than picking up Jonathan Smith, going and getting an offensive minded quarterback guru guy to go take some of these quarterbacks that are in the Midwest and bring them in, put them in a pro style offense, and let them go to work against the rest of the Big Ten, and allow this team that was only better than Iowa at scoring points in the Big Ten last year, get better. It's only up from here. They do have some pieces on defense. The problem is just the lack of talent. You've got to be able to steal some talent in there and make do with what you have, because face facts, Michigan State fans, you are the little brother in this scenario. You're not going to be stealing things from Michigan. You got to make do with what you have and punch up at everybody and then find your success that way. And they've proven that they can do it in the past. I think Jonathan Smith is the kind of guy that can get him to do it again. Don't forget, he did the exact same thing at Oregon State with Oregon, winning a couple of civil wars while he was there. So I think for the future, both programs headed in the right direction, have great head coaching hires. This season might be a little bit tough, especially given past expectations and hope and those types of things. But overall, I think they're both going to be fine with time. All right, so we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to update on some things that are actually going on right now rather than speculating about things ahead. We'll get you caught up on things going on with the Tigers and the Pistons next here on Mitten Madness, 95.3 W.
Detroit sports fans, Wolverines and Spartans alike, this is your sports show, Mitten Madness, with Jacob Harrison and Dejon Hughes on 95.3 WBCK.
Back here on Mitten Madness, 95.3 WBCK, Jacob Harrison and Dejon Hughes. Let's talk Pistons, Tigers. That's what's going on right now. We'll get things started with the Pistons. We're gearing up for the NBA draft in a matter of weeks.
Kind of know
what the Pistons are going to do here. It seems that Bouzelas and the Pistons are joined at the hip at that number 5 overall pick. I know it's the 5th pick, but it appears that everything else kind of is laid out in front of them, and that nobody else is going to be taking Bouzelas. And Bouzelas fits the roster nicely. He's going to help with their shooting and everything else that the Pistons kind of need. Still, the offseason is kind of really starting to get started now. As we're recording, the NBA season could be over by the time you hear this. We will be picking the game 4 finals game. But nonetheless, the season could be over. So give us that grace of a few hours. But NBA free agency is about to get started. And it's the opportunity for the Pistons to get better. ESPN kind of has a deep, deep dive into every single team in the NBA, what they need to do as free agency gets started and those things. And the team needs that they list for the Pistons, surprisingly, isn't just one bullet point that says everything. It says they need shooting, interior defense, perimeter versatility on the defensive end, a true veteran point guard, and the best one, a repetition of winning habits. So they could have just wrote, don't lose all the damn time, and got just as much out of that as well. Nonetheless, I think the veteran point guard thing is an interesting thing to add. Obviously, Jaden Ivey being the starting point guard. You got Cade at the 2. Everything else is kind of a little bit more versatile. I mean, you're not going to do anything with Duren. Obviously, Sar Thompson should be a fixture, you know, at least in the, you know, first 6 players. But nonetheless, you do have some other things to take care of in-house, as well as James Wiseman's contract if you want to continue on with that. A lot of the guys that came over in the Knicks trade are set to be free agents as well. Here's the thing. As far as cap space goes for Detroit, they're expected to have $66 million in cap space if Fournier's $19 million team option is declined, which is a real possibility. The Pistons are going to have to spend $127 million, which is 90% of the $141 million salary cap by the first day of the regular season. All these guys, I'm not sure how rookie contracts work in the NBA, but all these guys being so young, are they going to need to like really kind of strike out there and see if they can bring in a veteran point guard or a wing or something to kind of help in that regard? I mean, cause Bouzelas is, he's going to be nice, but he's not like a game changer as far as we can tell. Nobody in this draft class really is. Is that even an option for them? Is that something they can do? Are there any potential free agents that you know about, that can upgrade this roster in the meantime?
Is it an option? Absolutely. I think the harder part for them is finding out if anybody wants to come to Detroit. I think that's the bigger thing is when you're looking at free agency is you want that player to want to be there. You want that player to come in and be ready to help. But I don't know if you're able to find that with the Detroit Pistons. I think for me, their idea is you keep drafting and you look to maybe use some of that cap space to lock up some of these young guys for a little bit longer. Start looking at contract extensions and you look to go after a free agent in a couple years when you have a nice young core that has kind of figured it out, like what you saw from the Thunder this year. They didn't really have a veteran presence and they missed it. But yeah. I think if you look at what they do in free agency in the next couple of years, you could possibly see an NBA championship team if they get one or two veterans that can come in and help. I think the Pistons need to take that same kind of route, continue to go along this young route and build this young core to tie them up for quite a few years here with extensions because they do like playing together. They do like being in Detroit because they're young. You can use that as an advantage to keep them here for a little longer, really supplement that core, and then add your veteran pieces to it after once you know exactly how you're going to look as a team and what kind of direction you want to head.
Yeah, it's going to be tough to see how this team is going to improve. The comparisons to the Thunder are interesting because the Thunder are a young team that were coached really well. Like, that's how you get to that stage, how you do what the Thunder did last year. Because the I don't know, talent disparity doesn't feel that incredible between the Thunder and the Pistons, and I could be totally wrong on that, but being coached better to be in better positions, sure, they missed the veteran presence, but now you've shown that if a veteran wants to come in and play with this team, they can at least make the playoffs and make a run, you know? Maybe the Pistons have to do things the opposite way because obviously nothing's going to change on the coaching front. So it's difficult all the way around. Let's get to the Tigers real quick before we get into our picks in the next segment. 2-4 last week, losing both series to the Brewers and the Nationals. One of those games did go into extra innings. The first game against the Nationals really seemed to put up quite a fight outside of that first 10-0 loss to Milwaukee coming off a 9-1 loss to Texas, last week, but 5-4 in 10 innings to Washington, 7-5 in game two, and then winning 7-2. The Tigers are a better team than Washington, I think, by far. But nonetheless, you kind of land in the situation you land in, and now they're ranked number 18 after being 14, I think, last week in ESPN's power rankings. And I don't know how much of a loss it is, but Javier Baez is on the injury report because of a back issue. So, you know, he's been struggling all year. Bats do seem a little bit more alive right now, but tough road series coming up with Houston starting this weekend. Obviously, that started last night for you listening. And then the Braves, which is really, really tough. Then you do get a breather with Chicago. By the time we talk next, the White Sox, you know, obviously that should be easy pickings there, but I don't think it was early in the season. No, it was. That's why we started so well. Nonetheless, tough series coming up, but it does seem that things are trending in the right direction in some facets, though not always on the scoreboard.
Yeah, I mean, they're really just a average team. That's like all you can say about the Tigers is they're not going to lose too many games. They're not going to win too many games. They're going to win two series and then lose two series. They're going to win three series and lose two series. Like, they're just neck and neck with good and bad. There's no real jump for them. But I think that is a positive thing. When you look at the Tigers season last year and you look at where they could progress, I think they're headed in a right, positive direction. And they just have to keep at this pace of getting the bats slowly warming up and then keeping the pitching consistent, which I think the pitching has done an amazing job this year. And as these bats continue to bring in runs, things will even out and the pitchers will have to do less, which I think will ultimately make them better. And the one thing I have is, can we please trade Jack Flaherty? Sounds weird, but this team isn't going to do anything this year. So let's get draft capital or prospects or something for Flaherty while we can. Because he's a free agent at the end of the year. So I don't think he's coming back. He's having a very good year. Let's capitalize off that good year and try and build something for later before just letting him walk out of the door at the end of the season. That is the only reason I say that.
I don't feel great about that. I understand your reasoning. I'm not saying you're completely wrong or far-fetched. I would rather bring somebody in that can hit then get rid of the second best pitcher on the team that is helping now.
But he's going to leave anyway. You got to get something for him, right?
That's where we'll cut things off there. We're coming back and taking care of our picks for the weekend. So don't go anywhere. Stick with us here on Mitten Madness, 95.3
WBCK.
Time for our picks. Mitten Madness, 95.3 WBCK, Jake Harrison and Dejon Hughes. Let's get into it. DJ, how are those standings looking?
You went 4-2 last week. I went 3-3, which brings you yet one game closer.
Wow.
And you are just one game behind. I am.
Let's go.
62-40 on the year. You are 61-41. Definitely knocking on the door.
Now is not the time to get cocky whatsoever. I have learned from past mistakes. Got to just keep the head on straight. As I've said in the past, don't call it a comeback because it probably won't last for long.
All right. We've got the UFL Championship at the Dome in America Center, St. Louis, which is friggin' shame because that's the home of the St. Louis Battlehawks. And they're not playing in the game. The call lives on forever, but not in the UFL inaugural championship. That is going to feature the USFL champion Birmingham Stallions taking on the XFL champion San Antonio Brahmas. The Stallions are a 3-point favorite in Sunday night's game, which kicks off at 5 p.m. Eastern on Fox. DJ, who is walking away the UFL champion?
This one's plain and simple for me. There's one team that I've barely went against all year, and their record shows it. They are technically 10-1 on the year, and I've only lost one game. That one game is to this team, the Brahmas. As much as I want to choose the Brahmas because I didn't last week, it just does not seem smart. I'm trusting the Stallions to repeat, air quotes around that, as they won their respective league's championship this year. I expect them to take down the inaugural UFL and win a championship this year.
You know what's absolutely insane is the UFL MVP was benched in the USFL championship. Matt Corral steps in for Martinez, goes 9 of 11 for 120 yards and 2 touchdowns to beat Michigan last week. The other team, the one that Birmingham beat. I'm sorry. It's not right in front of me, and Michigan was. Nonetheless, I'm with you. If the Stallions are just as good, if probably not better, because come on, Matt Corral is way better than Martinez, then there's really nothing that's going to stop them here. San Antonio has been too inconsistent, I think, all year. I mean, point positive, the fact they lose to the Battlehawks to lose home field advantage, but then turn right back around to win the game to get into the UFL championship, but winning the XFL championship. Stallions are just way too consistent. I'm not saying it was a fluke the last time the Brahmas won, but Stallions are a considerably better team. But I'm up for that four-peat.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm going with the Stallions as well, which moves us on over to a game that is question mark. It comes on tonight. So putting that caveat out there, you guys, or tonight as in Friday when we record, you guys have already known, you know, how this shook down by the time you're listening to this. The Celtics have a chance to sweep the Dallas Mavericks in the NBA Finals. They're up 3-0. The game is in Denver at the American Airlines Arena. 59.1% going to Boston with a 1.5-point favorite. Kristaps Porzingis is a game-time decision, along with Luka Doncic being a game-time decision as well. Who comes out on top?
All right, let's be real. Luka and Porzingis are playing in that game. See, this is one of those situations where I don't want to feel like an idiot where I picked the team that lost the entire championship while they were down 3-0 before, you know, when that is going to air. Afterwards, you and I both were on the bandwagon that the Mavs were probably going to lose the first two games and then come back and win this thing in six. Well, obviously they ain't winning it in six. But I do think the Mavs are better than getting swept. Maybe the Celtics have pulled this one away, really are going to win that 18th championship, but I just can't see the Mavericks getting swept. So I think them pulling out that game 4 and then maybe losing next week when this thing goes back to Boston, maybe that makes the most sense, but I can't see them getting swept.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I'm going with the Mavs as well. I don't think they get swept. I think it's at best a gentleman's sweep, so we get 5 games, and I could even maybe see this one push 6 because teams start to really ball when their back's against the wall. So I'm taking the Mavs as well.
I don't think I've ever heard that phrase before, gentleman's sweep. Like, it makes it sound like we were nice enough to let you win one.
That's exactly what it is. Like, hey, here you go. You get one just to make you feel good.
You know what it's like to win a NBA Finals game, not the whole thing. Speaking of sweeps, Florida is looking to sweep Edmonton in the Stanley Cup Finals. The Oilers, they lost both their mojos and then some. They've got no help. They're taking this thing back home, but they have looked rough. They lost 3-0, 4-1, and then game 3 on Thursday night. night was a 4-3 loss. I didn't think Connor McDavid and this team would get bullied so hard, but Florida has really put a number on this thing. Again, though, the team that is down 3-0 is hosting game 4. DJ, can the Oilers stay in this thing?
I think this one's completely different. as much as I do think the Oilers will give them a game, it's been goaltending that's the real thing here, and Sergei Bobrovsky has been insane. I believe the Florida Panthers are sweeping the Edmonton Oilers.
Yeah, I agree with you. This one's completely different, but I look at it from a different perspective. Last week when I picked the Oilers to win game 1, it was because I thought they had such momentum based off of how they played in the playoffs, whereas the Panthers are just riding the wave of being the best team in the NHL all season. I guess Americans really are just better at hockey. I don't know, especially down in Florida. Panthers got this one. They're sweeping.
Gets us on over to the hardwood. We got some more women's basketball action to get into on this good Sunday. We got a weird matchup. The Storm are going to be taking on the Mercury. This game going on at the Footprint Center in Phoenix, Arizona. 58.6% chance for the Storm. And I mean, they're putting up 83.5 points a game. Phoenix giving up 85 points a game. We do know that no one's injured, so we're going to see Skylar Diggins-Smith, Jewel Lloyd, excuse me. And then, you know, you're going to see your Brittany Griners and Diana Taurasi's, who's coming out on top in this star-studded matchup that really has two teams toward the middle of the league.
I feel like there's plenty of reason here for me to pick the Storm, but I feel like the experience of the Mercury is just one of those. I don't think they're 6-7 bad. I think they're 6-7. It's a weird start to the season kind of thing. So I'm gonna stick with the Mercury. I don't feel super confident about it, but it makes sense.
You know, I almost chose the Mercury with them being 4-2 at home. But Seattle's 5-3, which means they both have won two more games than they've lost in this scenario, which doesn't give me any extra credit toward one side. But what I will say is this game could come down to the very last shot. And it's going to be a close game, but I do have the Storm pulling this one out.
That's fair. All right, let's get to the game where both these teams have losing records, but Lord, it's the only thing anybody will ever talk about with the WNBA. The Indiana Fever, who have won a handful of games here recently to get up to 4-10 after a very rough start, are going to be hosting the Chicago Sky, which is, I mean, one of the biggest rivalries in the entire sport at this point. Again, they're 4-7, 3-2 on the road, coming off of two losses to Connecticut and Atlanta. That's understandable. Those are two very good teams, or more so Connecticut than Atlanta, but you get the point. Caitlin Clark is averaging 15 points per game. Is also has six assists per game, and Aaliyah Boston just came off of tying her career high in points with 27 the other night, and she's averaging 7.4 rebounds per game. That's not to say, though, that Reese isn't having rookie of the year type numbers this season early on, and she's about to get her teammate down in the paint with Cardoso joining her as well. So Chicago should be a tad bit better than they've been, and they haven't been really all that bad despite their record. So DJ, who you got in this one?
When you look at their last couple games, the Sky lose the 1-point game to Indiana. You know, a lot of us watch that. They lose to Connecticut, who only has one loss on the season. And they lose to the New York Liberty, who have been absolutely balling. The Dream are a middle of the pack team. And then they did beat the Mystics like they were supposed to. Fever, on the other hand, just beat the Dream, last night, which was an amazing game. And in which Caitlin only scored 7 points. So for those of you saying she doesn't have help, you're wrong. They did lose to Connecticut. They lose to the Liberty big. And then they also beat the Mystics. So they're both 4-6 in their last 10. They're both giving up over 80 points. Indiana almost 90. Chicago, they're both scoring 78.5. In my opinion, Indiana got a little lucky that first time around playing Chicago. But these two teams do play each other again in exactly 7 days. They play 6-16. They play again 6-23. So there's going to be a lot going on as these teams see each other so often so quickly. I've got the Sky taking care of business this time around.
I agree with you for the simple fact the Sky are a better team with Cardoso on the floor. I know she hasn't played a lot, but I think the Sky are just better. Indiana's got to get to a point where Clark and Boston are both playing great. Like, you're not wrong. Clark has help. It's just 90% of that help is Boston. And that connection just hasn't worked so far this year. Once it does click completely, this is much closer to a 500 record team. They're just not quite there yet. So I'm going to stick with the Sky as well.
Which takes us to our last matchup. It is a series this time around. Tigers taking on the Stros down in Houston. Tigers right now 17-16 on the road. and the Astros 17-18 at home. When we look at how things are going to shake out, Scooble's going to be on the mound against today, or that was Friday, Flaherty and Verlander today on Saturday as you're listening, and then Sunday Maeda is going against Argetti. The Astros won the two out of the first three that they played against each other, but the Tigers do have two of their three aces hitting the mound, and Maeda hasn't been bad recently. Do the Tigers have enough to pull it out in this series against the Astros, or will a team that's kind of just wiggled their way into the playoffs every year figure it out again?
So I was curious, what is Justin Verlander's record against the Detroit Tigers? He's had seven appearances against his former team, 4-3 record with an ERA of 2.35 and 62 strikeouts. So not bad, not great either. Half the reason he's doubted Houston anyway is because that's kind of how his career has gone to this point. Not bad, not great either. That being said, I think he gets to 5-3. And that doesn't mean I think the Tigers are losing this series, though, because I think even though this game has already happened, I do think that the Friday game goes to Detroit, and I think that Sunday game also will go to Detroit. So I think them, I was a little hesitant at first. Houston is a good bit under 500, so I think they're a little bit worse than they should be, even though they are at home. So I'm going to give this one to Detroit.
And I'm going to follow right behind you. I think the Tigers are going to win this one as well. I have some trust in them, especially with two of their aces hitting the mound, which means down the board, we are the same with the Sky, the Mavs, the Panthers, the Stallions, and the Tigers. You're going to take the Mercury, and I'm going to take the Storm. Cool, so boy. That means either we're going to be tied next week, or I'm going to be enjoying a two-game lead. Get us on out of here for the weekend.
Yeah, it's going to be close. It's been a lot of fun. Even though we're getting deep into the offseason, there's still plenty to choose from. So we'll be back next week at 10 a.m. on a Saturday, as we always are. You can also catch us on replay at 9 p.m. here on BCK, as well as anytime on demand on the 95.3 WBCK app. So check us out there, and we'll see you next week here on Mitten Madness, 95.3 WBCK.
Join Jacob Harrison and Deja John Hughes every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. for Mitten Madness on 95.3 WBCK. Miss the show or want to play it back? Stream Mitten Madness live or on demand on the 95.3 WBCK app.